You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Ed Miliband's romances, forgetting the manifesto, you kept shouting, Box said binging, and we review newsoids.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to your favourite podcast from the Media Motel. It's the Parish Council. I'm Magnus Shaw, and every little thing he does is magic. It's Terence Dackham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Oh.
hey, did you get it? 20 days to go.
Yes.
20 days to go. Much to ponder since we last met with many surprises, particularly in the press, where it seems the Daily Mail think you should vote for the Conservatives, whilst the Guardian doesn't.
Yes, absolutely.
In the last week, the Daily Mail, under the byline of its columnist and consultant editor, Andrew Pearce, a man with peculiar views on particular subjects, so he fits in at the Mail quite well, the Mail published a piece that suggested Ed Miliband had courted about four women before he got married.
No.
All of them young, single, professional women. Were you shocked at this groundbreaking exclusive in the Mail?
I'd be more shocked if you hadn't. I don't know how you build a news story out of this, but somehow they've managed to. When one was at school, I mean, you probably didn't really have this experience. I suppose I didn't either, but we know that in the school playgrounds up and down the land, the talk is often of who is going out with who. Yeah, who fancies who and who's going out with who.
Yeah, you fancy her, you
exactly,
do.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And most of us managed to grow out of that, post-puberty. And somehow or other, the Mail have failed to get over this. So the idea that somebody dated somebody else is incredibly upsetting, arousing, and exciting for these sort of emotionally stunted people who then take to their paper and say, "You went out with a girl, you did." It's K-I-S-S-I-N-G all over again. Absolutely ridiculous.
It was an attempt at some sort of character assassination, of course, and demolition of Ed Miliband, but almost certainly had the reverse effect of making the Labour leader appear ever more human.
Yeah.
And he's probably had, by the dint of what we read in this absurd article, he's probably had a more stable set of relationships than many journalists.
Oh, yes.
Certainly than me, I have to say.
Yeah, like as you so rightly put it, the young man has girlfriend shock is just the same as naked person in bath shock, isn't it? It's like no more than. And as you rightly say, you know, for somebody who struggled with this very inaccurate painting of himself as an odd man, an oddball, to promote the fact that he did some normal things just bolsters up the campaign that he's running, I think.
So it's an okay week for Mr. Miliband.
Good week,
good week for Mr. Miliband. Perhaps not quite so much for Ruth Cadbury, the Labour candidate for Brentford and Isleworth. Being filmed for a local website, Miss Cadbury was asked about Labour's key manifesto promises. The trouble was she couldn't remember one of them, and she put her head in her hands in despair whilst being filmed. You've seen this clip. Should she be drummed out of the socialist paradise of Isleworth?
No, not at all. I think most of us would run the risk of doing this, wouldn't we, when put on the spot. It's often the things that are in the forefront of your mind, in your short-term memory, that flee away from you at moments of pressure. We've all seen clips of newsreaders forgetting their own name when introducing themselves on the news, and I think it's really something to do with the nature of memory, isn't it? That the things that you're actually currently working on aren't embedded in your long-term memory yet, and they're much more prone to depart. And on a more serious level, we've both known people who've unfortunately suffered with the dreadful disease of dementia, and the long-term memory is the last thing that leaves them. They can remember their childhoods and their professions and such like, but they can't remember the day of the week or what they just saw on television. And I think, to a much more trivial extent, this is the psychological process where people forget the absolutely key thing that they're working on at the time. So Miss Cadbury does have my sympathy, because it could happen to absolutely anybody, and did indeed happen to Natalie Bennett in that famous radio interview.
Yes, I felt awfully sorry for Ruth Cadbury. It would indeed be exactly what would happen to me. I'm sure, you know, with each passing year, I can't remember what I read in the newspaper 5 minutes ago, never mind manifestos and pledges, as you mentioned. But the thing was, she didn't have the practice bluffer's way of dealing with it, though. Now, I was picturing Boris Johnson in the same situation, and he would have just bombasted his way through, you know, such a faux pas. But she just stood there and melted, which, you know, I think probably I would have done too.
Yeah, she should have just said it's all in the manifesto, and that would have covered it, wouldn't it?
Yes. But meanwhile, with 20 days to go, manifestos were launched hither and thither this week, including UKIP's testimony to the nation, which was set on its merry way by an event to which, in common with other parties, both local activists and journalists were invited. And as we've come to learn, the party leaders give their speeches and then invite one question and one question only each from a handful of journalists from ITV, BBC, Sky, Channel 4, and then a few crumbs to print journalists. And on Wednesday at the UKIP manifesto launch, Christopher Hope from The Telegraph, he asked Nigel Farage why there was only one non-white person depicted in their manifesto. And Farage didn't answer because UKIP members heckled and shouted down the Telegraph reporter. Would you say this? Do you think it's a nail in the coffin of democracy, or just simply a reflection of the modern age?
I think it's a reflection of the way UKIP members feel about themselves, and there's certainly a siege mentality, I think, around UKIP. You only have to see the Farage performances on the couple of TV debates that he's been involved in. That he's constantly on a sort of aggressive defensive. If that's not a contradiction, or he's aggressively defensive, simply because he knows that the criticisms levelled against his party are of the most serious nature, and that is that they are racist. Now, we'll pass no comment on that in this environment, but it clearly touches a nerve when there's a suggestion of racism, and it sort of plays into their rejection of what they see as the overly politically correct environment in which they're operating. But shouting down journalists asking perfectly reasonable questions doesn't reflect particularly well on them. And it's almost a case of methinks thou dost protest too much. Because if they were very comfortable with the depiction of people in their manifesto, then they wouldn't have the need to shout. So, I think it was. I mean, it was not disastrous for democracy, but it did show an undemocratic streak in the party, yeah.
In a more general sense, I thought the incident reflects the latest, inward-looking movement in the presentation of senior politicians during an election campaign, in that every effort is made to keep them away from real people. Stage management is taken for granted now to such an extent that we expect only party loyalists to be invited to launch events, and indeed carefully vetted members of the public only are allowed into the television studio debates. And we had yet another one of those last night, this time without the Conservatives or Liberal leaders. I'm not sure what Mr Cameron was doing, but it's possible that Nick Clegg was still aboard the yellow Liberal Democrat battle bus, because the bus broke down twice this week, once in the middle of the road in Crouch End, so you can construct your own kind of metaphor. Last night's debate has its unique selling point, apart from the fact that Mr Cameron and Mr Clegg weren't there. It had a so-called red button feature that allowed the viewer to watch each politician's progress up or down, in favour or against, thanks to a running poll by Ipsos throughout the debate. You know, what did you make of the Ipsos Mori worm?
Well, I think it took a while to get going, and I did wonder whether the audience members forgot that they were supposed to be hitting numbers 1 to 5.
Yes.
I think that as soon as we went live, I wonder if they were a bit caught in the headlights somewhat, because for the first maybe 5 or 10 minutes, it didn't seem to be worming at all. It seemed to be...
Didn't do much wriggling at all,
no,
did it?
No, a piece of stringing. But it did get going. At first, I was concerned by the little disclaimer that we were in delay. And I thought, well, if we're in delay, how do we know what they're reacting to? But you could kind of gauge where to be looking on the worm, because when the speaker changed, there was always a reaction. So you could see where the point on the worm, where the reaction had started to change. I don't know if it told us an awful lot. And indeed, I think you could have drawn your own worm on a piece of paper as it went and been fairly close to the actual worm on the screen, because you can have a good idea what people will react well to and react against. I think, as you say, things are so stage managed and the candidates are so schooled that we didn't really have to see the worm, because there were very few moments where there was extreme reaction to what was being said, which would make the indeed any extreme things being said, which would have caused the worm to go up or down. But I suppose it was vaguely interesting. I hope it doesn't cost us license fee payers £250,000 to have it on screen, because I don't think it's useful enough for that. But yeah, it was okay to have it up for a while. I did flip back to BBC One, where the worm wasn't showing, and didn't seem to be available on the red button, to be honest.
No, well, actually, that's a point I was going to make on a technical issue. And, you know, one hates to say typical of the BBC, but, you know, you wonder, you know, did they trial this? Did they have all the fail-safes in place? Because I thought initially it was just me, but then I checked with you and it wasn't working for you. It wasn't working on BBC One or BBC HD. They had trumpeted this in advance. Press the red button, you can do follow the progress of the worm. It didn't work. We got sent to some episode of Food and Drink instead, didn't we, when you pressed the appropriate button.
Yeah.
And it was, again, no guidance from the BBC at all, but it was a Twitter follower who advised me to go to the BBC News channel where the worm was visible without any red buttoning. Why not try it, get it working seamlessly, you know. But, yes, the business about saying it was subject to delay did initially make it seem far less useful. And like you, I was thinking, well, what are they reacting to? But as it settled, it did become clear, and I think you're absolutely right, that initially... In the frozen arc of frozen arc of the TV hot light. The people were frozen, I think, and forgot to press the button. But as they relaxed, these 50 undecided voters did start pressing the button. But I didn't learn anything from it. I mean, because for example, there were two particular surges that I noticed. One was for Mr. Miliband, one for Miss Sturgeon. But it was more that they were speaking passionately about something that meant a lot to them. And I think, again, it's a natural aspect of human nature that we empathise when someone says, this means a lot to me, and we kind of, oh, let's send them a bit of love, you know. And so I'm not altogether convinced that the worm had much to do with it. And as you say, for probably 90-95% of the worming, it was stringing along in a straight line, more or less. So it told us nothing. Well, there was one, just going off the tangent a little bit, there was a curious bit at the end of this debate. I mean, it was utterly hopeless, where we went to what they were called the spin room, and Emily Maitlis and John Pienaar were presenting, and they were trying to whip this up like it was an American-style presidential election. Yeah, The Situation Room, indeed. But there was this curious moment where they interviewed two members of the public, which, shocking moment, a man and a woman. And the man said, Emily Maitlis said to them, so, you know, what did you make of it all? And the man said, well, I think the big winner was Nicola Sturgeon, and it certainly changed my mind because I was, you know, going to vote UKIP. So, first of all, this it shows you the standard of voter in this country. Because, first of all, this man was prepared to go from one extreme to the other in the space of a 90-minute debate from, you know, the relatively leftish, pretty much leftish, Nicola Sturgeon, to be entranced by her from the other end of the scale with UKIP. But also the fact he was in England. You can't vote for Nicola Sturgeon, well, man.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, indeed, you can't vote for her in Scotland either because she's not standing. But, she's not a candidate.
Is that so?
Yeah, she's not even standing. I mean, of course, when people say I'd vote for the decision, they do mean the SNP, but you're quite right in saying that most of us can't vote for SNP. And I wonder how many people who've been watching these debates think you can.
Oh, equally, I notice a lot of love, and this is a bit of an anomaly as well. I notice a lot of love on Twitter for Leanne Wood from Plaid Cymru, which there's the clue. She's from Wales. She's only, you know, the Plaid Cymru only work in Wales.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a curiosity there that I have sat through the debates with Leanne Wood in it, and each time I think she's done tremendously well. I think she comes across as a really pleasant person, very sensible and very likeable, and Twitter reflects that. Then I see the immediate polls afterwards, and always in each of them she polls at the very bottom with only Natalie Bennett ahead of her. Mm. Yeah, and you know it says, you know, Miliband 30%, Sturgeon 30%, Leanne Wood 2%.
Yes.
Well, what's all that about? You know, I thought she's doing really well. It's peculiar.
I agree. I mean, perhaps she's almost too nice. And I think because of the referendum earlier this year in Scotland, people are very aware of Nicola Sturgeon. I would guess before these debates, a fairly large percentage of people didn't really know what Plaid Cymru was. Wasn't really, you know, they weren't really aware that there was a party for Wales, and therefore they're just not accustomed to her and reject her out of hand. But it is a bit of a mystery, yes. Mm.
Well, stay with television, but move away from the vexed world of politics and the election 20 days to go. There's an ever-growing trend on television, and it expands year upon year until just about every programme features someone doing this. And I want to know what you, Magnus Shaw, plan to do about it. I refer, of course, to the growing practice of presenters having a go. I'll give you an example from one of the worst culprits, which is BBC One's Country File. Oh, no feature can be complete without Matt Baker or Adam Henson or Ellie Harrison, whoever, getting stuck in. And one of these ne'er-do-wells will visit, let's say, a rope-making shop in Yorkshire, and you hear the fateful words. Then Martha, the rope-making expert, invited me to take a turn on the cord wangler. And yeah, we're then forced to watch John Craven grinning inanely while spending sort of all of 10 seconds weaving some twine. My question is, why, Magnus Shaw?
I think a producer would argue that this is the point that the presenter becomes the audience. They're our proxy. So we've watched the expert do it, and they imagine that we've said, oh, I'd like a go at that. Oh, I wonder what that's like. And the presenter then does it on our behalf, so we can, A, see how difficult it is, and B, appreciate the skill of the person who's very good at it all the more. But it's, yeah, as always, it's a television trope, isn't it, that having established itself, every producer has to include it in their programme, and we start to get heartily tired of it. But I think that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make the presenter the audience's proxy. I think that's what the argument would be.
But you see, I don't need Julia Bradbury to make tea on an open fire, to feel included in the ambience of a show. I think the producers are making a mistake.
Yeah.
The worst culprit, and I believe really the generator of this, the sort of modern age of this, this is sort of modern nonsense, was Stephen Fry when he presented a really dreary six-parter in 2008, Stephen Fry in America.
Oh, yeah.
Because he had to have a go at damn everything. It was like ice fishing. Stephen Fry makes ice cream with Ben and Jerry. He swam with sharks. Everything he saw, he had to do. Now, I contrast this, because I find this style of presentation so terribly distracting. I don't feel included. I contrast it. I long for the days when someone like Kenneth Clark would simply stand in front of a building or a painting, yeah, and just tell us about it.
Yes, yeah.
Kenneth Clark, he didn't ever say, so I thought I would add my own entry to the Book of Kells. You know, he just told us about it.
Yeah, you do actually get some of that, but you know, mainly on BBC Two and BBC Four. Andrew Dixon Wright does a lot of arts programmes where he just explains what you're seeing and why he loves it or otherwise. So it does still happen, that sort of formal style of presentation. But of course, mainstream programs, the producers are terrified that they'll be, you know, accused of being boring and stuffy. So they have to take the presenter away from that traditional role and get them, I don't know, mud wrestling or walking on Mars or whatever it happens to be.
See, in my house, we sort of, you know, there's an audible groan because you see Matt Brett, you know, and coming up now, Matt Baker visits a sheep shearing farm. You just know. So I thought I'd have a go with the shears. The other thing with Countryfile, and we have this game with Grand Designs and Countryfile, is to have a bet on whether the presenter will walk off to the right or to the left in each piece, because with an alien coming down to Earth would think there's this peculiar thing where people will die unless they do this. You know, they walk up to a camera, say, and you know, of course, across this stretch of the Yorkshire Dales, the manifold sheep really do need shearing three times a year, and then they walk off camera every single bit. They can't just stand there and then the camera just cut to another shot. Every single time they have to walk out of shot. So they walk into shot. Oh, look at this delightful Aysgarth Falls here in the Yorkshire Dales. Isn't this marvellous? And then they have to walk out of shot. So stay put, but we have bets.
Yes.
On whether Kevin MacLeod in Grand Designs will walk up to the left or right, or Matt Baker or Ellie in Countryfile will go off to the left or right.
And here's another one to look out for, is the I have stumbled upon trope.
When they're meeting a man in the Yorkshire moors.
Yeah, Matt Baker's meeting a Yorkshire shepherd. So instead of just cutting to him saying, well, here's Tom, he's been a shepherd all his life, da 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 da, he has to walk up a small hillock and say, ah, you must be Tom.
Every single time.
And the poor fella's been asked to play along, so he goes, oh, is it Matt from Countryfile? as if they've just stumbled across each other. So, I wondered what this the crew of six researchers and a cameraman and a sound boom were doing here on my farm. Now I know, because it's you, Matt Baker.
They take us for ages. Magnus Shaw, that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's all constructed, isn't it? To I suppose to avoid that sort of staccato, here's a thing and here's another thing. It's all to blend one's, you know, sequence into another, and I don't suppose it's all that troubling, but it can, you know, it does leave it open to mockery, I suppose.
Oh, they do it every time. Here's another one, Escape to the Country, one of my favourite shows ever. You know, I often will have my brunch or lunch, because it's always on the Really channel or the Home channel, yeah, whatever, and I love it. But It's in the real world, their visit to the properties spread over two days, a couple of properties on the first day, another one on the second day, and then the what bit I love, the mystery property on Escape to the Country.
This is all new to me, you see.
I see.
I work during the day, you see.
Oh, good God. Oh, I couldn't bear that. Now, what happens is, when they want to transition between the 2 days of filming, every single, there must be 10,000 of these programs in the vault. Every single time at the end of day one, and anybody who watches it now will be sitting and they'll be going, I know what he's going to say. They say, as the sun goes down over the Devon Hills, or as the sun goes down over the Pennines, we come to the end of our first day of House Hunter. Every single time. It must be in the contract that you have to say, at the end of the day. And it's always, you see a shot, a romantic shot of Glastonbury Tor with the sun just dipping below it, as, you know, the feckless couple who are pretending that they want to move to Somerset from, you know, they're from Croydon. And they wander around these properties saying, oh, it's got a lot of natural light. That's another thing that makes me want to throw things at the television. What do you expect to be coming through that window, madam?
He's on one now.
There's a lot of natural light.
Do you feel that the cutaway shot of the sun going down has been culled from the BBC library rather than?
I think they shoot it. Well, it's there, but they just do it with every flipping show. You must watch one episode of Escape to the Country. There's several presenters over the years, but my favourite is Alastair. He's a Buddhist, and he wears Buddhist beads around his wrist, and he's so calm, and he's such a nice man. I like Alastair. I'm
pleased you've got a little television friend there. That's
nice. Yeah, he's my special friend that I talk to every day.
How lovely.
And I think sometimes he sends me secret signals through the television to acknowledge that I'm watching. Escape to the Country, yes.
The script writer is he just has a template script, and he just changes little details, so you always get that as the sun goes down.
Do you know, I really think they do. They have a compliance form. I think they have a script template that is forced to say, as the sun goes down over St. Leonard's-on-Sea.
Yeah, and he just changes that end bit every time.
yes. Now, here's a link, Magnus Shaw. Here's a really good link. I was just talking about Kenneth Clark. And Kenneth Clark's Civilization is now available as a box set of DVDs. And binge watching of shows, either by the purchase of a physical box set or by downloading, is increasingly popular. See that link there?
That's very, very clever.
Only a few short years ago, we would watch an episode of our favourite television drama, say, and then we'd have to wait a week for the next episode. But now, however, people more and more want to grab the whole series in one go and watch when it suits them, not the television company. You're one of those people, Magnus Shaw.
Yeah, I am. At the moment, I'm absolutely immersed in Netflix series House of Cards with Kevin Spacey. It's an American iteration of the, you probably remember the BBC series. Mm. Certainly on a grander scale than the BBC series, but I mean, that was a beautifully written series, and this is just the same, and it's really high quality box set stuff. But it just made me think that I think box set TV is one of the greatest gifts the internet has ever handed us. It's just such a wonderful experience. Provided the show is good enough, and not all of them are, but the House of Cards certainly is, because I think it's the closest to reading a thumping good novel that digital media can give us, because just like a novel, you can pick it up and read a little bit, you can pick it up and read for many hours, and it gives you that accessibility, and the fact that you can control the input, you can control how much of it you consume and when, it does really, really give you that sensation that you're reading a really, really good book. And you know that feeling when you start a book and you know it's just going to be for you, and it draws you in, you know, almost helplessly draws you in, and you really annoy people by sneaking off to read a bit more. I mean, my mum was like this about Wolf Hall. We didn't hear from her for about a week. I haven't heard from you all week. Mum said, no, I've been shut in the house reading Wolf Hall. And I think she's read it 3-4 times since. And that's very much like the box set. And as I say, I'm in the throes of this at the moment because I'm completely addicted to House of Cards, just the same as I was with The Wire. And also a show called Boss, which didn't really catch anybody's attention, which was a Kelsey Grammer drama, box set drama, where he plays the mayor of Chicago. If anybody comes across that, it's worth it. It didn't ignite in the same way as some of these have. And of course, House of Cards arrived on Netflix complete. You could watch the whole thing in one sitting once it was released. They released every episode at exactly the same time. I'm always late to these things. I think it's been sitting there on Netflix for about a year. Having decided I was going to plunge in, wow, it's such a great experience. And somehow it just... you're just absorbed into it all the more because you can activate it whenever you want. And so I doff my cap to Tim Berners-Lee for the old internet because it's one of the greatest pleasures the internet affords, I think.
I do the same thing. I've watched most water cooler shows, the big shows via download binges over the last few years. The Sopranos in particular. In Treatment, The Wire, Veep, West Wing, 30 Rock, all by either back-to-back episodes, you know, of like having a binge day and just, you know, essentially slumping on the sofa and watching, you know, 10 episodes in a run.
I'm doing it sort of 3 at a time.
I generally settle though into watching a few episodes a day over a week or two, and I find that otherwise I think you get a bit kind of overwhelmed, and I get distracted if I try and, you know, really sort of binge.
Yeah, I think I've done 2 seasons in about a week and a half. So, yeah, that's about 3 episodes a night. Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that I found when I did that with both The Wire and The Sopranos, which is binge watching, I became so immersed in the story that it almost dominated my life for, like you're saying, there may be 10 days of watching. So I became so immersed in it in that... if I went out and I, you know, so say I went out for a walk or something, I'd find that my mind was thinking, you know, about Tony Soprano Stringer Bell.
Yeah.
So it really can, but you know, I don't say that's a particularly bad thing.
No,
but,
That's what I like, that you're you have an alternative world to slip into. I really enjoy that. Yeah.
But you know, you were saying, you know, relating it to Tim Berners-Lee. I mean, the thing is as well, our lifestyles now, you know, aren't set up that way of having to watch a season of these shows over, say, 26 consecutive weeks. No. We just don't live like that anymore because, you know, we've got 500 TV channels. We've got Twitter, Facebook, Periscope, an avalanche of distractions. So yeah. we've really come to a point where we want what we want. And we want it now.
Yeah, you said. Having said that, I do agree with you. But having said that, Wolf Hall, to go back to that, the TV version went out episodically. You couldn't grab the next one from anywhere. You had to wait till next week, and that did lend it a certain preciousness. And I could never remember what night it was on, such is my failing memory. God forbid I should ever have to remember stuff out of a manifesto. I could never remember which night it was on, so I would sit down and grab the TV guide and go, oh, it's Wolf Hall night, and that little thrill of knowing that you've got a new Wolf Hall was also very rewarding. So it kind of made it more precious.
Do you think there's a divide, firstly, between American and British productions? Because first of all, every production I think that we talked about there about binge watching was, I'm fairly sure, between us, American productions, whereas Walpole was a very typically British thing where time was taken and there was a lot to absorb and it wasn't all sort of rush, 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 one-liners, bang, bang, bang. It was a more stately show. Do you think maybe there's a kind of Atlantic divide?
Maybe more of an urgency in these American shows that do drive you on to the next episode. I mean, intentionally so. I think they're created in that way. Yeah, so Walpole didn't leave you cliffhangers as such, although it did on some occasions. But it proceeded at a more sedate pace, certainly. And,
do you know what? I think there's something in this, Magnus. Sorry to interrupt you, but I'm just now thinking. I just thought of Downton Abbey.
Oh, yes.
And I'm not sure I'd want to watch that in a kind of five-episode blast. I think there's something to say that, let's just drift into this every Sunday night. Maybe there is an Atlantic divide.
Make me wonder about budgets, because watching House of Cards, it's like watching a shortened movie, an hour's worth of feature film each episode you watch. There's no commercial breaks on Netflix. But the production values are as high as any movie you would go to see. I mean, they've recreated the Oval Office. They've recreated presumably they rented a very posh house in DC to be Frances Underwood's house, and so on and so forth. But no commercials to back it up. It's not brought to you in association with anybody. It doesn't break off for adverts. So how would somebody like Netflix fund such a thing?
Actually, that's on the point of watching not live as it goes out on television, so whether it's binging as a box set or recording, I think that's a really big point, because increasingly now, because I and yourself as well watch television in that way, I become increasingly irritated by commercial breaks, and particularly by stingers where a show is sponsored. So, but like, your favourite, The Chase, with those two, absurd women from Auntie Betty's products. And I was thinking just then of Downton Abbey, which was sponsored by the Kindle in the last series or two. And I find that very jarring, particularly in costume drama like Downton Abbey, and of course anything that would be shown in the States live, where a dramatic moment happens and suddenly you're being sold insurance or some sort of medicine for something or other. And of course, when you watch it as a box set in a binging session, you don't get the commercial break.
Yeah, absolutely. I think House of Cards must have cost millions of dollars to make, and I don't have the answer. Perhaps somebody can tell us, how did Netflix fund House of Cards? And they have other...
It's subscription, isn't it?
It is subscription. It would take a lot of subscriptions to fund what is essentially a very extended feature film with Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright.
Maybe a lost leader, maybe?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, obviously, what Netflix have to do is what Sky eventually managed to do, was to say, if you want this television that we have, you've got to subscribe. But, there's some serious dollar being bandied about in these productions, and then the temptation to have found a sponsor for it must have been great, but it isn't sponsored in any way at all. But I'm glad they did, because I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, that's good. If you, our favourite listener, were to look on some DVD covers on the Internet Movie Database or even Wikipedia, you will see my name listed as a contributing writer for the first six seasons of the television show Spitting Image. In the 26 years since my last contribution, barely a week goes by without someone asking me, why don't ye lot bring Spitting Image back? And my usual reply is that it was extraordinarily expensive to make.
Yeah.
And that it was very much a product of its time, and that I'm not sure it would work so well in the modern age. Well, to a degree, we got to see if my theory holds water this week, as ITV on Wednesday showed the first in a new series that shamelessly leaned on, rather heavily, on the memory of Spitting Image. Has the age of satire returned with ITV's Newsoids?
Well, a brilliantly hilarious script, marvellously matched to the mouths of outrageously funny puppets, in a raucous satire on the modern world. Now, that's a perfect description of the movie Team America World Police. Which was out 5 or 6 years ago. Newsoids, however, Newsoids, sadly, isn't fit to lick the miniature boots of Team America World Police. Badly written, infantile in all the wrong ways, less effective in satirical terms than a sixth form review. This was a hopeless attempt, I think, to resurrect the glory days of Your Spitting Image. And, almost entirely for its duration, fell flat on its face. I think ITV would be well advised to pull this. It's not doing them any favours at all. In fact, it's quite embarrassing.
It was immediately apparent to me that this was a radio show with low budget puppets, in its style and format, in terms of the budget spent on it. As with any satirical, and I put that in enormous quote marks, as with any satirical show, all hangs on the script. You can have the best puppets in the world. This didn't have them. You can have the best voice actors in the world, but it all comes to the script. I actually made a bullet point note saying, is there actually a script here? Because it just seems so thrown together. And I know I'm very old-fashioned. I know I'm a fuddy-duddy. I know I'm aging. But I found a couple of the skits quite offensive for different reasons. There was an offensive sketch halfway between a sketch and a skit, a sketch about the royal family, a really tasteless joke about Andy Murray on his honeymoon, which I just thought it wasn't funny. But I thought the worst one in terms of tastelessness and offensiveness, it was a routine about abusive relationships, and it was sort of interviewing, like you would get in a commercial that is trying to raise money for an organisation that would help people who've been in an abusive relationship. So it was constructed as an interview with people in abusive relationships, except it was with Nick Clegg and David Cameron. Now, whatever spin you put on it, abusive relationships are not funny.
No.
And that made me recoil. Mm-hmm. I must say.
Mm, yeah, it really did just smack of sixth form sketch humour. I don't know who the writing team were, but I was going to say, I wonder if it was the interns, but that would be very unfair on talented interns working in television. And as we've said before, with the shows that have attempted to be funny, there must be dozens and dozens of people out there who could build a genuinely funny script for something like this, who are just overlooked because they're not in the sort of broadcast loop. They're not on the Rolodex of the producer's desk. And therefore it wasn't funny. And I think I don't particularly object to humour that is, in inverted commas, offensive. I think that's all part of the creative process. But it's got to be funny. It has to be funny. Because if it's not funny and it's offensive, then it is just offensive. And I agree with you. The sketches which sort of seem to pride themselves on going near to the knuckle just weren't funny enough to have that license, and it just struck me as failing on all levels, I'm afraid.
Another very basic error I believe they made was that they obviously felt that they had to impersonate, almost imitate, try to imitate, to get an accurate voice representation of the puppets that they were showing. And that was, I know I'm going to say, oh, well, we didn't do that in Spitting Image, and anyone could say to me, well, that was a long time ago, old man. Fair enough. But I think it's a big mistake to think that you have to create an accurate a vocal representation of the person. What you actually need to do is exaggerate it wildly.
Uh-huh.
So that in itself becomes funny. You know, you pick on a particular point like we did with Douglas Hurd, who had a bit of a peculiar voice, but, you know, we made him speak like this. And, of course, Mrs. Thatcher, you know, with the wonderful Steve Nallen. But, you know, he could do an accurate representation of Mrs. Thatcher, but he exaggerated it wildly so that it became funny. Here, you know, John Culture in particular, I felt was just trying to sort of show us, oh, look how close I can get to the real voice of this person, which, of course, isn't funny. You might say, oh, you know, that's quite clever because that did sound like whoever, Nick Clegg or whatever. But that in itself isn't funny. Speaking of which, though, it was a badly done, an overlong representation of Mr. Cameron, and I don't say that, you know, in any sense, supportive of him, just factually. They went to this burger joint drive-through, and the gag was based purely on the premise that a posh person might not understand the McDonald's menu and ordering process at a drive-through. That was it. There was no payoff. There was no twist. There was no incisive satirical gag. No. It was just, oh, a posh person might get confused at McDonald's. That was it.
Yeah, yeah. So, it makes you wonder whether we're squandering the freedom of speech we have in this country. Because, of course, a show like this in many countries around the world would see you imprisoned and worse. Fortunately, in this country, we can mock the powerful, but I think that precious gift could be better appropriated than here.
Magnus Shaw, on that point of, you know, with the freedom to satirize, of course we were shown a clip of Kim Jong-un, which of course in North Korea, you know, that such a show wouldn't exist. However, my point with Kim Jong is that when a character has to tell you who they are, the show's in trouble. And Kim Jong-un appeared on the screen. He says, hello, I'm Kim Jong-un. Well, you know, if you've got to do that, pal, then, you know, you've got to work harder.
And that was completely lifted from Team America World Police, where his father, Kim Jong-il, is
on the Kim Jong dynasty.
Yes,
there,
indeed, but. Yes. Yeah. Well, he's absolutely beautifully satirized in Team America World Police. He even has his own little song called I'm So Ronery. And that appeared to me to be a complete lift from another much, much, much better puppet satire program or film, yeah.
Well, and of course, this Kim Jong-un sketch was based on just simply on being able to create a pun around the un. You know, so it's the un show, it's the one show and so on. No, that for me, the halftime commercial break came as a blessed relief, having talked about commercials being a pain earlier. I thought, oh, thank God, it's, you know, here comes the stinger for the sofa company, so it's halftime, thank God.
But isn't it an awful shame? Because I do think on, you know, national UK television, there is a market and a gap for a really good weekly satirical news show that isn't a panel program, you know, that is scripted and in sort of sketch format or whatever. We don't seem to have one, and the prospect doesn't seem to be looming either. I think maybe perhaps, as you pointed out before, it's harder to satirize these sort of ping pong balls with faces drawn on them that we have now as our as our leaders, whereas when you were writing Spitting Image, we had these really sort of pronounced characters as our government and as
across the cabinet. Right across the cabinet and the shadow cabinet. Yeah. People could name, the pretty much right across the front benches of both parties, mm-hmm. because people, you know, rose to power and were allowed to be eccentric and odd and unusual with unusual characteristics. Yeah. Everyone, to a man and a woman, they're scrubbed squeaky clean. Poor Mr. Miliband, you know, is laughed at for the way he eats a bacon sandwich. It's about the furthest you can get in terms of eccentricity. And by the way, they even pulled on that. I mean, you know, that gag has been done to the nth degree, isn't it? You know, Ed Miliband eats a bacon sandwich awkwardly. You know, get over it. You know, it might have been funny for a day, a picture of him, you know, but they, it was one of the premises of the early part of the show. But yeah, so sorry to interrupt you, but just look at the contrast of the material that we had to work with. If you look at the say 1986 and look at the cabinet and the shadow cabinet and the, you know, the extraordinary array of characters, and the only kind of non-party leaders that they could bring in were Ed Balls and Yvette Cooper. I think everybody else that they featured was the leader of their party because of that. But as you say, if you're going to characterize people with really low budget puppets, then the Bristol show has got to be damn good.
It wasn't. I agree.
So, well, it's hard to see how they're going to string this out for 6 weeks. I call it spitting image light without the budget, cast or writers. And I believe it did show, reinforced my very first point on this, which showed we have never recreated or reincarnated, I should say, spitting image. This was Newsoids on ITV on Wednesday at 9:00 p.m. It starred John Culshaw, Deborah Stevenson, Lewis McLeod and Simon Greenall, and it was directed by Dominic Brigstock and George Kane.
And sadly, that's where we must fold up the parish council for this week, sliding it back into the podcast airing cupboard until we come back again. We're off to play this back, but this time with the Ipsos Mori worm superimposed on all our witticisms and sage words. You just watch that baby wiggle. Let me thank the dazzling Terence Dacom.
I'll be seeing you.
And of course, many thanks go to you, our favourite listener. There's much more at therockingvicar.com. That's therockingvicar.com. I'm Magnus Shaw, and until next time, bye-bye. Woke up this morning, got yourself a gun. Your mama always said you'd be the chosen one. She said, one in a million, you got to burn a shine. You're born under a bad sign with a blue moon in your eye. Woke up this morning, baby, I believe that you're feeling fine. Shade of my life, no longer a bad sign. With a blue moon in your eyes, so sing it now. Woke up this morning, you got a blue moon, got a blue moon in your eyes. So sad, goddamn shade of my life. Woke up this morning, you got a blue moon, got a blue moon in your eyes. Down. Load of other things ain't been the same since the blues walked in a town. Get you one in a million, cause you got that shotgun shine. Shave my body, bone under a bad side. Blue
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.